Hi, everybody.
Hi.
I'm glad some of you already know me. So thank you so much for being here on a Friday night. This is the very last of our Colorado finalists book readings. And this is the, third year, I think, that we've hosted these now, which is crazy. So we obviously are a small, independently owned, by me, bookstore, and thank goodness, thank goodness we have indie bookstores that are thriving like ours. We're about to celebrate.
Thank you.
Give yourself a hand, because it's because of you, and it's because of organizations like Colorado Humanities that stores like mine are able to thrive in communities like this, and the authors, local authors that just keep coming back and bringing crowds with them. We're going to be turning 4 years old at the end of May, so you're all invited to our big party that we're going to throw with cake and champagne. But tonight, we're celebrating a successful series of Colorado finalist readings, and we're going to cap that off with the Colorado Book Awards on May 21st, and I'm sure these guys are going to give you more information about that. But again, thank you for being here on a beautiful Friday afternoon, crammed into a small space. And it's so good to see a crowd like this come out for local authors and for Colorado Book Awards. So I'm going to turn it over to Maggie Koval, who is going to introduce the authors and give you the rundown for the events tonight. But thank you again so much for being here. I want to make sure you know that we have brownies and cheese cakes over here, and then we also have $9, is that right? $9? We have a Prosecco special. $9 Prosecco. So, partake, because it's for you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nicole. I'm going to pull this down here so I can see what I'm doing. This is kind of high, especially for tall people. I want to thank Nicole and all of the folks here at Book Bar for what's been a wonderful series, and we're looking forward to seeing you at the Colorado Book Awards on May 21st. Before I go on, I also want to thank Beth Mayer right here. She's the coordinator for the Colorado Book Awards and does all the hard work getting all these books in and judged and arrangements for the readings and for the event itself. So thank you, Beth. So, as Nicole said, this is our last in the series of finalist readings for the year, and we're happy to have you all here to celebrate three categories: general nonfiction, literary fiction, and poetry. And I really do appreciate the opportunity to introduce you to, I think it's eight now, right? Eight talented writers whose books have been named by an army of volunteer readers, the finalists of the Colorado Book Awards in these categories. So literary fiction will start, followed by poetry, and then general nonfiction. We have so many writers, we're going to try to move quickly, keeping everyone to their time limits, but we'll be polite about it. There are copies of all the finalist books available for purchase, and we also hope, as Nicole said, that you'll enjoy the snacks and drinks during the readings and after. So at Colorado Humanities, we're all about the conversation. So we want to make sure we have time after each writer reads to ask a few questions. So get your questions ready. And we'll also have a little bit of time at the end of the evening for everybody to come back and answer a few questions if you wish. So without further ado, our first reader this evening is Stephen Schwartz, reading from Madagascar, New and Selected Stories. Stephen is the author of the novels Therapy and A Good Doctor's Son, and four collections of stories. He has received the Nelson Algren Award, the Cohen Award from Plowshares, the Sherwood Anderson Prize, two O. Henry Prize Story Awards, the Colorado Book Award, Award and a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship. He teaches in the Warren Wilson MFA program for writers and is Professor Emeritus of English at Colorado State University, where he is fiction editor for Colorado Review. This collection spans nearly four decades of artistic mastery. In these compelling, deftly crafted narratives about fathers and sons, loss and separation, sorrow, comic happenstance, and the vagaries of romantic and familial love, Schwartz offers a resonating testament to the depth and promise of human connection. Please welcome Stephen Schwartz.
Thank you, Maggie. Thank you, Maggie. Thank you to the Colorado Humanities and to the Book Bar for having me here. And I'm proud to be among all the other finalists. I'm going to read a short excerpt at the beginning of a story called Bless Everybody, and this takes less than 5 minutes. They've been led to a lamb. The woman Meredith was far along in her pregnancy, and the coincidence of her name being close to Mary struck me. No place to lay their heads as they awaited the birth of their child. I own 200 acres cut out of the red rock along the Wyoming-Colorado border. Indians had long ago run stolen horses into the Box Canyon at the end of the property, and after them, rustlers had done the same thing with cattle. I poked around in the red dirt and once dug out the shoulder bone of a bison as big as my thigh. Arrowheads, spear points, and shards of clay pottery I turned over to the local museum. Rumor had it that this was as sacred ground as any that ran along the Front Range from Colorado to Wyoming. Buck Foster, my neighbor of the JC 200 acres, had given the couple my name and number and told them to call me about the one-room cabin on our property. The young couple had parked outside the gate and took it upon themselves to walk the land and see if they could find a person who resided over this magical place. It seemed like a good story, this being led to the land. I didn't believe in Providence, but I was retired and had time on my hands to be amused by such notions and told them I'd meet up at the gate to a property. That R is mistaken. I'm divorced, and Rosalind took her share of the property in a cash settlement. I used a chunk of my retirement money to buy her out. I'm 68 years old, and I'd worked as an inspector for the highway department 39 of those years. I'd always wanted a piece of property, as fiercely beautiful as this one. Every time I passed it on the road at sunset, the red rock glowed like hot coals in an evening fire, a view of the open-hearted earth. When it went up for sale, I talked Rosalind into putting our money down. I was land proud, no doubt about it. A little stream called Watson Creek ran through the valley and turned to cottonwoods leafy with shade in the spring, as they were now. They were waiting for me by the gate. When I'd spoken to the husband on the phone, he described their lifestyle as migratory, but he certainly didn't sound like a dangerous drifter. I'd have put the man in his mid-20s and the woman a few years younger, and their Volkswagen bus older than the both of them combined, rested on his fenders and painted a robin's egg blue with a bumper sticker on the back that said, "Bless everybody, no exceptions." The van's tires were bald, and its squirrel had picked up a couple of tumbleweeds and was chewing on them like too much spaghetti in a child's mouth. "Thank you, sir, for meeting us," Albert said, sticking out his hand. He was a thin man with a big toothy grin and blonde hair down to his collar, his eyes all fire at hello. He tipped his hat to me, a brown felt fedora with a white feather tucked in the band. They showed me their wares, ceramic leaf earrings and beaded hemp necklaces, tiny sweetheart notebooks no bigger than the palm of my hand, with paper that still looked like the wood it came from, sassafras and strawberry-scented brick candles in day-glow colors. They went to craft fairs and sold what they could and took temporary jobs. "We're realistic people," Calvert said. "You can't live off today what they did in the 60s. 60s or not, they didn't look like they had a practical bone in their bodies, not with that baby in their future. Sir, we'd just like to stay here a few nights, Calvert said. We want our child to observe some of this, to spread his skinny arms in a panorama over the expanse of my land. Holiness, before we move on. I thought, people really talk like this? He patted Meredith's swollen stomach. She looked as if she were due any day. Where are you going to have that baby? Calvert clasped his hands together. Wherever we may be. I looked at Meredith, hoping I wasn't hearing what I just said. But she had that dreamy, come what may look. There's a good hospital in town, I said. We should check in with them. No need, Calvert said. We'll be taken care of. I said. We just followed our hearts here. We came over the pass and looked down and just knew. Isn't that right, Mare? Meredith nodded. Still that dreamy look. I'd feel much better if you saw a doctor or midwife while you were here. We've got a clinic in town that helps those in need. You are a kind man, Calvert said, as if my reputation preceded me. Your hospitality will not go unnoticed. Mary's stomach made a shelf of the long dress she was wearing, a thin, faded shift of yellow daisies, not suited for pregnancy, just oversized. Her ankles and toes had a film of dirt, and I wondered how long it had been since they'd had hot showers. Thank you.
Does teaching creative writing affect your writing thing?
Well, I'm retired now. I think my writing has moved a little bit. But, you know, the answer to that is you read a lot of bad writing, you read a lot of good writing. And sometimes some of the most stimulating writing for me has been student writing. Because I'm paying such close attention to it, I'm having to work with a pen, you know, marking all the craft and everything about it, and then going into workshop and talking about it. So, you know, it's like, in a general way, any piece of writing that you read, you just don't know as a writer, you know, what's going to resonate with you and what's going to affect you. And it's such a mysterious process. It's unpredictable. So, you know, I would say it's mostly been positive experience for me teaching. And I really can't imagine a more complimentary job. Yeah. Yeah, anything else? Yes. Yes.
So how did you have something in mind for the
structure? Well, some of the stories are from different volumes, and some of the stories are new. So, you know, with a story collection, unless you're writing a linked collection where you're actually thinking how they're all going to go together, you're writing these individual stories, and you're hoping, and this is probably something I should really emphasize, you're hoping they all go together, and what you're counting on most as a writer is your obsessions, that you're going to write about your obsessions. Even when you don't know you're writing about them, they're going to come out, and they're going to be combined with whatever stage of life you're at the moment, and whatever you're preoccupied with. You have some natural obsessions that never go away, and you have the stage of life you're at. And if you keep yourself aware and you keep antenna out in the way writers have to, you know, you wind up something that's true to yourself in that way. What?
Thank you. Thank you, Stephen. We have another Stephen coming up next. Stephen Dunn will read from his novel, Potted Meat. Stephen was born and raised in West Virginia, and after 10 years in the Navy, he earned a BA in creative writing from the University of Denver. Some of his work can be found in Columbia Journal and Granta Magazine. Set in a decaying town in southern West Virginia, Potted Meat follows a young boy into adolescence as he struggles with abusive parents, poverty, alcohol addiction, and racial tensions. Using fragments as a narrative mode to highlight the terror of ellipses, Potted Meat explores the fear, power, and vulnerability of storytelling. Please welcome Stephen Dunn.
Very good. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. I'm going to read two short ones. Who you are out. You hop in the trash truck and start collecting before the sun fully rises. In the alley, a bloody mouth raccoon gnaws on a white baby shoe. It stands on a mattress with piss stains. A yellow blob of chicken fat traced by a trail of ants. The chicken fat slugs along the mucus path. A batch of flies pile on the exposed red tendons and bone of a dead leg severed at the knee. Three rat-like kittens moan like babies in a soggy cardboard box. The fourth kitten is silent. Only the head remains. Its deflated body lies shredded on the other end of the mattress. Draped across the tops of three trash cans are large bouquets of funeral flowers, wilted off-white and droopy pink roses buried in four deep green leaves. The sun peeks over the mountains, rays poking through fog, tinting everything soft yellow. Love. Behind the house, over the hill, and up the side of the other house is a groundhog family. All day I watched them waddle out the hole and eat weeds. Mr. Ray likes to eat them, but he's too old to hunt. He pays $15 for a fat groundhog, $20 for skin and gutted. I need money to buy my girlfriend a necklace for her birthday. Spray turpentine on my shoes to keep snakes away. Carry a .22 rifle, a sickle to chop tall stalks, swing, chop. A snake hangs from the mulberry tree. I raise my turpentine foot to scare it away. Doesn't work. Rub dirt on hands and grip sickle handle. Step back and measure the swing like baseball. Draw back, step, swing. Snake head drops while body squirms and squirts blood. Wipe it off my face with the back of my hand. Sit on mound behind groundhog so I can blow his fucking head off. It never comes. Take the same route back to avoid cutting weeds. The snake body still hangs. Stand on other hill at distance. The groundhog rattles out, sniffs air, and waddles on. Choose weed, sniff air, choose on. Breathe in, hold, squeeze trigger. Groundhog tumbles downhill. I run to get it. Clean shot in the neck. I think the bullet went through. Plunge my finger in the hole. Miss you warm. Flip groundhog on its back. Its full belly jiggles to a spread like a rubber hot water bottle. I saw somebody do this before. I think I can do it. Stick knife in bullet hole. Kiss to make hole bigger. Saw skin and meat and cords around and around until head hangs. Hack at neck bone. Toss head in the weeds. Slip knife point in ass. Slowly slice upward towards belly. Knife slips too deep. Stomach spills open. Guts flop out. Keep working knife upwards to where head was. Skin unzips like a coat. Red spoke soft. Pull out all organs. Toss in the weeds. Wipe blood hands on my shorts. Get back to the house and spray the groundhog with water and put it in the plastic bag. I yell through the screen door. Mr. Ray, I bought you a groundhog. ain't asking no damn groundhog, he says. He tells me to come in and show him anyway. I don't know how to spin it, I say. And you ain't cut the feet off either, he says. What the hell am I supposed to do with a furry groundhog with feet? I tell him why I need the money. He laughs and says, all right now, the young man trying to get him some shrimp. Put that groundhog in the refrigerator. I'll get somebody up here to skin it. He gives me $15. I thank him to start to walk out. Hold on now, he says. He gives me 10 more. Make sure you get that gal something nice, a real nice necklace. My cousin drives me an hour to the mall. I buy a Tribe Called Quest tape, a Snoop Dogg tape, Newports, and a cherry slushie. Thank you.
Question for Stephen?
Yes.
How did you come upon writing this fragment? It's a lot very poetic as well. And when did you know you had, did you envision the whole thing like this, or did it come together as a novel eventually?
It came together. I was in therapy, and my therapist would ask me to sit with an image for a long time, and when I would sit with an image and I couldn't go any further, it was fucking terrifying. So that's how the book came about, that stopping somewhere, stopping in fragments was really haunting for me, so I thought that the book could have that also. Yes.
What made you choose a groundhog for your animal?
Because I've shot him before.
In terms of therapy, did this writing novel have an effect?
I don't know. Maybe. I think so. I'm sure it did. I haven't quite named it yet, been able to identify if it did or not, but I think so. So I think it was called body-centered therapy, so it's like, what's the first image to pop into your head? So maybe that was the most urgent image inside of me, and then I just went with it, whatever that was. So I followed that during the writing of the book, just paying attention to what image or what showed up, you know, try to write it. So.
It sounds from your bio that you have a little bit of the same background as the characters in the book. How much of this is biographical? How much is just one to go with?
I don't know. I didn't make up a number. 69.3% autobiographical, and I don't know how to do the rest of the math. But a lot of it's just influence. I don't know the real the quantifiable measurement of that. So. Yes.
I teach high school students, and I'm wondering what your pathway was, like as a kid and as a young person, what type of writing did you do?
I thought I was a painter. I painted a lot, so that's what my pathway was. So.
Yeah, I was just wondering where the title came from.
I think it is a symbol of poverty, poverty, but also, like, for me, the idea is reading the back, the label looks really nice and gourmet, but when you read the ingredients, it's really gross. And so these, as long as the can is closed, or still these nasty ingredients are preserved, so my concept was to open this can and let all of this shit rot like it already is. So, you know, all right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's see. Our next finalist actually couldn't be here tonight, but I'm going to recognize her. Her name is Mona Awad, and her book is 13 Ways of Looking at a Fat Girl. So we're sorry to miss her tonight, but we wanted to make sure we included her mention in the program. Let's see. Our next couple of readings are poetry. Right? We're moving to the poetry category. Reading first is Wayne Miller from Post. Wayne is the author of four poetry collections, Post, The City, Our City, The Book of Props, and Only the Senses Sleep. He has also co-translated two collections and co-edited three books, including Literary Publishing in the 21st Century and New European Poets. The recipient of the Rilke Prize, the Lyric Poetry Award, a Ruth Lilly Fellowship, and a Fulbright to Queen's University Belfast, Wayne lives in Denver, where he teaches at CU Denver and serves as editor, managing editor of Copper Nickel. The poems of this fourth collection from Wayne Miller exist in the wake of catastrophe, thrumming with pathos and humor, pain and the beauty of living. Post coalesces around three primary occurrences: the birth of a child, the death of a father, and the seeming explosion of socio-historical and political conflict and violence over the past 15 years. Please welcome Wayne.
I'm just going to read a couple quick poems, I try to pick ones that don't require a lot of setup, so I'm just going to dive in. But I will say that this first poem is a post-elegy. There are a bunch of post-elegy poems in the book, and I think of a post-elegy as sort of the way in which a loss is sort of resonating in the mind after it's no longer acute, the way it sort of hits the imagination, which is to say that my father died in 2008, but that none of these post-elegy poems are directly about him. They're indirectly about him. Post-elegy. After the plane went down, the cars sat for weeks in long-term parking. Then, one by one, they began to disappear from among the cars of the living. When we went to retrieve his, you drove the rose of the lot while I pushed the panic button on the Saab. Inside, a takeout coffee cup sat in its cradle, a stem of decay floating beneath the lid. I'd ridden in his car many times, but never driven it. When I turned the key, the radio opened unexpectedly like an eye. I was conscious of the ground passing just beneath the floor and the trapped air in the tires lifting my weight. I realized I was steering homeward, the down payment of some house we might live in for the rest of our lives. I wrote a bunch of this book living in Belfast, Northern Ireland, and I was there in 2013 when the flag protests were happening, so the whole 7 months we were there, there was just rioting going on around us, so this poem is sort of about that. It was also interesting, the riots would shut down at like 9:45 every night, and they could not figure out for a while why this would happen, and then at some point someone realized that all the kids, because they were mostly teenagers who were rioting, were going home to watch themselves on the 10 o'clock news. The next generation. They're gathering in the streets and lifting themselves from the earth. They're hovering, throwing rocks and gasoline. They're flying through storefronts and alleys. They're smashing plate windows to road faults. They're lifting heavy-vested policemen and dropping them on cars. Baton rounds whir into their mass, landing against wounds, then falling away. Those children have risen into the air, lit orange from flares and cars set ablaze. They circle above us. We try to pull them down, but they kick and soar higher. The newscasters explain and exclaim them, clutching them in language they never would use, language that lifts them, but they're already flying out of the streets. The city's dome of light is anatomical, a stain, a turgid sack. Inside it, the buildings are puttered and griffined, and along the bottom, the children's graffiti musses the surface. It glows in our window and grows as I prep my next lesson, as we feed our daughter who smears her cuffs with applesauce. By 10, the three of us are asleep, and out there, it's suddenly finished. The children are back in their rooms, watching themselves when they flew through the air. There I am, they say, and point to the screen. Post-elegy. 1. For 4 years I kept your ashes in the trunk of my car. They rode with me to work and back home along the highway's greased tube of air. Someone would say, what a perfect American burial. Evenings, I pushed the remote and the garage door unsealed like the door of a crematory. Then, all night, the day's accumulated heat slipped out of you. I never even removed the box from its postal packaging. 2. Finally, I took the box of ashes to the beach, where once I'd watched you swim, drunk in the turbulent aftermath of a hurricane. I dumped the dust at the lip of the waves, and they swallowed it up. It was easy as that. Thank you. Oh, I do that a lot. Yeah.
Do you want to talk at all about the relationship between the reader and the author and the subject?
I think in that particular poem, I wanted the poem to feel propulsive. And I think that's the primary purpose of the meter there. Yes. Yeah, so my first two books were fairly normal lyrics. They were not interrelated, but they were individual lyrics in a book. The third book was The City, Our City. It was a kind of coherent world-building space in which all the poems were unified in this sort of mythologized city that the book is set in. But that book has a lot more sort of historical and public, for lack of a better term, subject matter. It's a less private book. It's more interested in the city, a kind of public space, public moments of public interaction. And I wanted this book to be a kind of blend of those things. So I think that there are a lot of personal poems in this book, there are a lot of public poems in this book, and I wanted them to sit side by side and talk or not talk to each other. Yeah.
Do you think in terms of a book when you're writing, or are you writing kind of individual poems to be published? I mean, you're the editor of Proper Nickel, so a lot of times, these poems, people's poems appear in this journal or that journal, kinds of collections. Did you think of this as a collection as you were writing, or did you get to a point when you thought you had enough poems
I always write, I've done this so far with my books, I write for a while, and then I collect what I have and look at it and think about, it's kind of like Stephen Schwartz was saying, what kind of obsessions are you constantly obsessing over? And at that point, sometimes I see the potential to pull what's there together, as I did with the last book, and in this case, I was trying to figure out how to create some dissonance within the book, but I would say I probably had about 30 pages, and I put that together, and I thought, what do I have here, you know? And at that point, I start writing into the book a little bit. I have an awareness of what's going on in there and where the next poem might fit.
Well, question.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, Ruth Ellen Coker will read from Third Voice. Ruth Ellen is the author of several books of poetry, including Ending in Plains and One Girl Babylon. She was recently awarded a National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship. Congratulations. Her poems have been translated into Persian in the Iranian literary magazine Shir and have appeared or are forthcoming in various anthologies. She has taught for the University of Missouri, Southern Illinois University, the Indiana Summer Writers Workshop,
Prop and Washington State University's Summer Writing Program, among others. Praising the power of lyric drama, T.S. Eliot described the use of third voice as a means for characters to address and interrogate one another, and second voice as a way for characters to talk to the audience. In this daring new book, the principal narrator presents as a caricature reflecting the tangible experiences of a disembodied I posed against absurd selfhood, a voice imbued by sublime otherness. Ruth Ellen, please join us. When I heard you say this was for tall people, I thought I'm a goner. This book is, I was doing some research and I came across a few old books for which the copyright had run out at the turn of the century, and they were books about how to stage a minstrel show. In my studies, I learned a lot about minstrel shows, but it had not actually occurred to me that there were how-to books that people used because it was like local dinner theater. So the book is set up like that, and the main character is a minstrel character who is an American studies professor. Does it have anything to do with me? Okay, so I'm just going to read three quick poems. She's asked about the sublime and says, not Berryman, but then what? What is it about this kind? What about this kind is it that makes disagreement so disagreeable? Meaning, that kind of woman red wing floating in a field beneath a mountain range, not anyone in particular, but white peaks, extraordinary, incapable rendering, unknown mathematical vision of rock and ice, all the same, the horror the mind cannot comprehend. Meaning, articulate, that's why we hired you. Nice skin, your hair looks better straight. Knowledgeable, you seem so angry. Look at her, just a little daft. Someone who uses the word reference as a verb. Just a little bit slow. This is not about race, it's about aesthetics. Another voice says, you wanted someone else. Whether the substance of knowing that voice matters or not. The effort to charm becomes painful and is felt to be wearisome. She marks this page of her book. The inter-objective way to say blackness is, the wind causes the chimes to sound, the wind causes the doorway to moan, or she's drunk, she's lazy, she's no Mr. Bones. Don't be angry. I don't know what primitivism has to do with anything. She is an embodied form of difference, the sublime body displaced for aesthetic vision. Lacey laughs too loudly when someone says bipolar or booze. Lazy Lacey, all Baldwin, all Brooks. Misunderstanding is understandable and will go away. Smile, smile, smile. Many hours, Tuesday, 2 to 4. Nodding, smiling, implies she understands. Smiling, especially, dispels rumor. Oreo 65. In the minstrel, there were different parts. There were olios, which were intermission performances in front of the curtain while they were changing the scene behind their skits, their stump speeches, etc., etc. Olio 65. A pink sweater
not dark but light, almost not pink. Her tongue, a flower, which he says isn't pink because no pink exists in nature. But we brought him pink, pink everywhere, in beer bottles, in milk containers, in our hands, in bunches, everywhere, which made him love us and hate us as we loved him and hated him. His tongue was not pink in the way you imagine, but in the way red fades from being red, although red is not part of this story, because red turns away from pink as a brother turns away from another brother when a woman is involved. And her pink sweater pushes each to think pink nipple, pink lip, pink flower, in the way Boethius thought pink flower, thinking woman, thinking man, thinking to keep the allegorical away, because the allegorical does not tolerate pink, which is soft and weak, because it is nature at its failing, because a girl sparkles from her feet to her head in pink backpack, scarf, gloves, because she is too young to understand how pink hits a woman, because she is too young to know how pink hits a man. Last one. I got married a year and a half or two ago to someone who's a little older than me, and so I got a grandson. And all of a sudden, the worry that every woman who has a black son has came over me for the first time. Six. Sun Ra welcomes the fallen. Jupiter means anger. Sun Ra does not. Sun Ra dances the cakewalk on Saturn's pokey eyes. If you believe that, I'll tell you another one. The first is 13 and the next is 20. They were not good boys, but they were boys. They were boys who died for this thing or that. The next was 16 and the last was 18. One had a cell phone, one had a gun. On Earth, a goose opens its chest to a sound. The goose takes the bullet this way, a sacrifice denied to the wind, since there is no such thing as sacrifice anymore, having succumbed to fever and the millennium. The bullet is all consequence. Sun Ra refuses red, high and low, low and deep. His arms are long enough to embrace them. Thanks.
Question.
Right there. Why did you come up with the line "Jupiter means anger"? Well, there's a composer named Holst, and he has a piece called "The Planets," and my college boyfriend listened to it all the time, and I always argued with him that Jupiter was more angry than Mars, because Mars is supposed to be the god of war. But for Holt, Jupiter seemed a little bit more testy.
Another question?
Can you tell about what compelled you to do research?
I had the character of Lacey first. I was at a time in my life. I've always had this, I came from a different life, a different lifestyle. I grew up in a housing project in the northeast of Pennsylvania that was filled with poor white people. They don't know that, people don't know there are poor white projects, but there are. And so, you know, as I enter into my professional life and professionalism and good manners and no temper, inside my head, that project girl is jumping up and down a lot. And she's saying, really? Like, really? She's going outside? Right? And so in my older self started to see her as a minstrel character. And I had a kind of black militant. I was single for a while, and I was all over the place. So there were a couple months of this black militant boyfriend. And he, if I would really have a bad day, he would make this joke, and he would say, well, you know, out in the world, we're just lazy niggas, right? And so he started jokingly calling me Lacey. Lacey, like lazy. So that voice in my head transformed, and I really realized that she's a minstrel character, and so I started researching it that way. And it's rare to have female minstrels. So that's how it came about. Thanks, that's a good question. Anybody else? Thank you.
Thank you. So next, Carolina Eben will read from You Ask Me to Talk About the Interior. Carolina is currently studying in the PhD program in creative writing at the University of Denver and holds an MFA from the Michener Center for Writers at the University of Texas. She has been awarded fellowships and prizes in poetry from the National Endowment for the Arts, Red Loaf Writers Conference, and the Stadler Center for Poetry. And she grew up in West New York, New Jersey. I didn't know there was a West New York, New Jersey, but maybe we'll know about this more about that. You Ask Me to Talk About the Interior emerges out of the ontological shock and double bind of there being a world rather than nothing at all, and inhabiting this world that depends on violence. Drawing on influences such as Barthes' notion of the punctum, to the repertoire of circles and twirls bullfighters make with the red cape to attract the bull, Ebbett explores a poetics that is at once intricate and intimate. Please welcome Carolina.
Thank you, Maggie and Beth, and all of you. It's great to be in your company. I, too, have a certain relationship with podiums, Ruth Ellen. The Passion of Joan of Arc. Those minutes, they were like marble or timber or frozen grass. They were made of hacksaws and sawing, and furthermore, with words that disappeared, like the word for jackal, for abstract, for other. Above the scene, a mercurochrome corona around the sun, that throbbing welt of a sun without the heat that kisses the cheek. And the words continued to fade, the names for woe and want and wait. And they weren't being replaced, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw a lion tearing apart a jackal, and nothing replaced the jackal. A decreation was taking hold, my mind itself becoming the paradise in which you, O Adam, Adamah, walked about backwards, unnaming the front from the base, until there was one, only one last likeness left in my antinomian mouth, and then I was standing under a red arcade of flowers. Albeit, because I have wanted to make you something beautiful, I borrowed a book I had to keep, a beehive made of glass, an observatory of translucent arteries lit with rain gossip, an allegory for the soul. Though what do I understand of beauty that thrives in a place of exile? These can anger so. A ghost of killers has swarmed a boy beneath the window sill. You said the soul to be. Vegetables flower outside, squash blossoms. And for what is that an allegory? We live in a copy of Eden, a copy that depends on violence. I have one more poem. This is called Lead, and it has an epigraph by Primo Levi from his The Periodic Table. The ashes of who knows how many other elements full of life, which thousands upon thousands of years ago were burned in their own fire. Because the window is open to the noises of the street. Because the bell is made of seeds for birds. Because they will pick apart the bell. Because this is what living things do. Because lead rhymes with dread. Because from another window the names of boys are called in. Because the birds with thin whistle throats pattern back to the crests and buildings. Because the shadows of the mountain. Because that mountain stretches up and up forever into the skies. Because I cannot write about lead and how my son was poisoned. Because windows are only holes fitted with sheets of glass. Because of the starless, the unnegotiable above. Because of the barrel and the coal in its veins. Because it is measured in micrograms of lead per deciliters of blood. Because the weather-flung thing leaves an aneurysm in the glass. Because the gray horse strayed from his kin and died at the base of the mountain in prehistory. Because an epoch of its sleeping. Because we have the tools to unearth what has been buried and put it on display. Because my son's first word was circle at the Museum of Modern Art. Because we were born in prehistory. Because we will be buried for epochs. Because everything made tells its story, the window, the circle, and the canvas. Because the toy horse is pulled by a string. Because we call it a living room. Because a woman is talking on a screen. Because a journalist has been hanged. Because last words want to be hymns. Because the flock crowning the tree makes an oily colossal of wings. Because final words inflate of the possibility of. Because those words become artifacts. Because Zeithen continues to be used for its status as the last word in many dictionaries. Because Zyklon B canisters found by the Allies were arranged into a pyramid of artifacts. Because this is what living things do. Because you took an object that was once whole and you smashed it. Because Zeithen was a kind of malt beer for thousands of years in Egypt. Because there is a seat here, and you could join me for a while and drink with me. Thank you.
Questions?
What are you working on now? Well, I'm trying to write a book of poetry, and the working title right now is called Hide. And it is a lot about American violence and the feeling of hiding, but it is also about early writing and how a lot of early writing took place upon vellum, which itself comes from hide, the skin of animals. So that's what's prompting me. But to tell you the truth, I have been writing a lot of essays. I find prose to be a lot more, I find that I want to say something and clearly, and that's not often where my poetry goes, and so I find prose to be more useful right now. Yes, Julie.
Who are some of your strongest influences?
You know, I can never think of recent influences. I can only think of the first few, and I would say the work of Lucy Brock Boido, who was instrumental in my writing, encouraged me early on. Gerard Manley Hopkins, still, really. Someone like, well, John Berryman was, I think, an early influence. I know Ruth Ellen referred to some of his problematic poems, dream songs. Yes, but honestly, more recently, I would say someone like Susan Howe. Nikki, I'm sorry. I feel like I'm in class. I'm like, Carl, then Nikki.
It sounds like you enjoy interesting words. Mm-hmm. Do you have a particular relationship with words?
Oh, yeah. I find that often when I'm writing, I have several books open, but also the OED. I do love finding the history of words and not only where they originate, but how they are used throughout history. I would say that, yes, that really gets me going. Yes, but I don't know any writer that who wouldn't be. But I would say, yes, that I have a certain relationship to words and what they mean and how they sound. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I was really intrigued by your first answer there about prose taking place in poetry since I can. Why those broad use of poetry?
This is a very difficult question. But I remember recently in an interview having to talk about this very thing, so this image comes to mind of a tapestry. I think because of this, there's a lot of sewing going on this cover, and the tapestry having its front face being a theme, let's say a pastoral theme, and the reverse of it being, I don't know if you've seen the reverse of tapestries, but they are knotted, and you can see various colors, but you don't see a particular perfect set of images. And I, for now, my poetry, I would say the reverse side is what poetry is, and the front side is what prose is. And they're both very useful, and they both perform each other. All right. I think my son has a question.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
The possibility of terrifying and hopeful to be at the same time. Was there ever anything after that that you took it away, or was there
the possibility of what did you say?
Nothing. In your life, you just have the possibility of.
Oh, right.
I think that's it. It's stuff like that.
Yes, I have a blank next to it.
So, did you ever have anything in that blank and you took it away, or was there nothing ever?
I think there was nothing ever there. You can write it in. Okay, Patrick.
Okay. Did I really get my poisoning?
Oh, God. I don't know. I mean, everyone in this room probably has lead poisoning, being of a certain age, growing in American houses and their paint. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, our final group of readings tonight is the general nonfiction category. So first, is Paula Woodward reading from We Have Your Daughter, The Unsolved Murder of JonBenet Ramsey 20 Years Later. Author and investigative reporter for news station KUSA-TV in Denver for 32 years, Woodward's stories prompted legislators to create new laws and sent criminals to jail, and have been recognized with multiple Emmy, Edward R. Murrow, and Society of Professional Journalism Awards. She has written for both the Rocky Mountain News and Denver Post, and since retiring from broadcast journalism in 2009, she has been digging into and writing about unsolved murders. Forget everything you think you know about the unsolved murder of JonBenet Ramsey. We Have Your Daughter presents an unprecedented insider perspective into one of the most heinous unsolved crimes in American history, and fully examines evidence and insights from law enforcement, the Ramsey family, and their defense attorneys. Presenting never-before-seen writings, drawings, and photographs of JonBenet, Woodward also paints a portrait of the real six-year-old girl behind the tabloid beauty queen stories and photos, capturing her short life and lost future. Please welcome Paula.
Very glad to be here with you all. I am always amazed and a little awestruck by what comes out of people's minds and souls that we're hearing tonight, and the diversity of the writing. I just think it's just incredible. I really do. Thank you for being here. We Have Your Daughter is taken from the ransom note. The picture on the front is the last photograph her dad took, and that was Christmas morning. Probably 12 hours before she was tortured and murdered. I covered the story as a reporter the day after her body was found. How many of you know about the JonBenet Ramsey murder? Okay. I think that this was the first example of real, I don't like the term fake news, but lying, myths, rumors, all of it. And so this book was an investigation of the examination of the case. And I asked all the people that I knew, gave my home phone number and said, please send me accurate information. And that's what they did. I was very lucky because I got police reports and no one else had gotten them. This first reading is short. It's when John Ramsey finds his daughter's body. There was only one detective in the house for 6 hours, and she told John and a friend, hey, why don't you look around and see if you can find anything unusual. And that's when he went to the basement, to the storage room. John undid the latch and pulled the door open. Inside, the darkness of the bare storage room was solid and still. He turned on the light. Milliseconds of reality blasted towards him. It was an ugly room that was mostly square with a short left side wall that led to a corner and then a longer straight wall around the corner. The room was all concrete, from the walls up to the ceiling and down to the moldy floor. The open door allowed light from the hallway to help illuminate the dimly lit, barely used space. Just around the corner, JonBenet was sprawled on the dirty floor, arms above her head, a blanket from her bed, casually or tightly, there are different opinions on this, covering part of her body. Her favorite pink Barbie nightgown was on the floor next to her. This is taken from John's journal. It was written for 11 months after her death. This is his writing. John, I see instantly what I know is JonBenet. A white blanket from her bed and her face is turned to the left, black tape on her mouth. Her arms are above her head, tied together with a shoestring type cord. I notice a red spot beneath her skin at her esophagus. A rush runs over me. Thank God I've found her. I fall down over her, say, come on, baby, talk to Daddy. I rip the tape from her mouth. Her delicate eyelids are closed. And her skin is cool to the touch. Come on, honey, oh God, no, talk to me, talk to me. I start to untie her arms as they are bound tightly. I've got to do something. I'm totally out of my mind now. I pick up Jambre and start to rush upstairs. All I can do is scream. My screams are those panic kinds of scream you have after nightmares, just before your body shakes awake with a start. The scream. And now we're back to me writing. A deep primal scream of father's anguish welling from the depths. A tortured cry that reached those on the floor above, foretelling news of a child's death. John kept screaming, his body shaking. And then there's one more portion that I'll read, and it's, there's a lot of diversity of writing in the book, and there has to be because you tell the stories about the people, but you also, I also tell you the information that I found. I was the only one who got police reports. This was the police report from the first officer on the scene from Boulder Police. It's a very short reading. For years, members of the media, the public and law enforcement agencies have asked why the first two on-scene officers failed to find Jean Bonnet's body. They arrived only 10 minutes apart. The answers were in first responder Officer French's report and also in a statement made to Officer French by the second officer to arrive. Despite a case littered with police leaks, this information was not leaked and was known by only a few officers and attorneys. In his report, he says, in the basement, I attempted to open the door leading to the area where Jean Bonnet was ultimately found, but it was secured by a wooden latch above the door. The door opened inward. It didn't. It only opened to outward. And I was looking for access out of the house. Since the door could not have been used for that purpose and it was last closed, I did not open it. French wrote this part of his report slightly more than 10 hours after Jean Bonnet's body was discovered. Here's why the statements he wrote about the doors are incorrect and misleading. The door opened outward only, not inward. French could not have known that there was an exit out of the room unless he opened the door and looked into the room to find out where it led. I did not open it, he said. In a later interview by other officers, Officer French finds the wine cellar locked, they report. Officer French thinks the wine cellar door is nailed shut. And when I got this information, it was from sources. They said, here's my home address. Mail me information, then I could double check and triple check. What I'm interested in is how we, the media, I was working for Channel 9, were so duped. And then how there was this groundswell of hatred against the Ramseys, guilty or innocent. And that hatred still exists today. And that's what I wanted to examine. And found out that it was mostly because that week between Christmas and New Year's, come on, we all take it off. So the rookies are left behind. There were rookie cops. There were rookie reporters. People were called in off of vacation. And the police leaked in the first week probably 10, well, the police, probably 10 flies that the media did not double check. And I'm part of that media. I didn't report any of those. And that's documented in here. And it kind of gives you an idea of how 24/7 news, the internet and computers and cable and satellite have led to so much inaccuracy in our world today. Anyway, thank you. I wrote it because I wanted to know how what we've done wrong, and I found out. Thank you.
Questions?
Figured it out, what happened after the game?
I know that I have an opinion, but the book does not advocate an opinion. The book gives you enough information, I think, accurate information, to decide whether or not you think it's an intruder or a Ramsey. I have my own opinion, but I'm so tired of people telling me how to think. And I think there are so many smart people, like in this room, who can read and figure it out for themselves. And I think that that's the big question. Ramsey or an intruder? Big house, lots of room to hide. Thank you all. Go ahead.
I think the term fake news is a cliche, but I believe in the concept. I think that what we are getting today from so many people is just wrong. And that you really have to search and read lots of different resources before you know what's right. The FBI director being fired. Is that the right decision or the wrong decision? Is it based on Russia? Is it based on the email? You better the email problem. I don't know. Does anybody here know? But that's what's so important about a democracy. And that's why we have to stay educated ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you, Paula. Next, Grant Collier will read from his book, Colorado Then and Now. Grant has been working as a professional photographer since 1996. His images have been featured in magazines throughout the United States and Europe, and he is the author of 12 books, including Colorado Yesterday and Today, Colorado's National Parks and Monuments, and Arches National Park by Day and Night. Two decades ago, Grant Collier embarked on a project that had him following quite literally in the footsteps of his great-great-grandfather, the pioneer photographer Joseph Collier. He traveled throughout Colorado taking photographs from the exact same spots where Joseph captured his images over a century before. In 2001, Grant released a book of those photographs entitled Colorado Yesterday and Today. Colorado Then and Now is the sequel to this book, and it contains 200 new photographs. These images capture in stunning detail the changes that have occurred in Colorado over the past 145 years. Are we going to see images? No? We're not. Well, darn. So I'll have to get the book. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you. Right, thank you all for coming, and thank you, Carl Humanities and BookBar for hosting this. And this is the book here. I'll show you a few images. It's big enough that you can sort of see the concept. But what I like about this reading is I think nobody ever reads the text in coffee table books, so it's something of a captive audience. You're forced to at least hear some of the text in the book. And I'll start with the introduction as it gives a broad overview of the project. Time moves inexorably forward. We are powerless to stop it. Moments in their lives are so fleeting that we can barely grasp them as we hurtle into an unknowable future. Our memories can only retain imperfect impressions of these moments as they sink irretrievably into the foggy abyss of the past. Perhaps this explains the allure of photography. We can capture and freeze a two-dimensional representation of a moment in time that would otherwise be gone forever. We are provided with a comforting illusion that we have some mastery over time. Photographs seem to become more powerful the older they are. People with memories of historic events inevitably pass away, often leaving only photographs to memorialize the past. I first became captivated by historic photographs in 1993 when I got a summer job digitizing thousands of early Colorado photographs. Many of these images were taken by my own great-great-grandfather, Joseph Collier. I started to wonder what it would be like to revisit and rephotograph the same spots that Jessica and I traveled to over a century before. In 1995, I decided to make this dream a reality. I set off with a camera and a book of Jessica Curry photographs. I first headed to Central City and Blackhawk, since Jessica Curry lived there for 7 years and took many images of the area. When I developed and put in my first images and carefully compared them to Joseph's shots, I found out I was usually off by 50 to 100 feet. I returned a couple times until I finally captured images from nearly the exact same spot Joseph had stood. Just with time, I became much better at finding the precise locations where Joseph captured his images. However, some of the photographs still presented considerable challenges. Joseph left little information on where his images were taken, so I often had to scour through all documents, books, and photographs at the library. Sometimes the difficulty lay not just in discovering where Joseph had stood, but in getting to those spots. In order to capture an image of Mount of the Holy Cross, I had to climb Notch Mountain, which rises over 13,000 feet above sea level. When I got to the top, I realized I had climbed the wrong ridge. Joseph had taken a shot from a spot to the south that was only accessible from a different trail. I was able to find a rock that resembled the one in the foreground of Jessica's photograph and captured a fairly similar image. I should mention that I had gotten back surgery a year before and was in no condition to be climbing mountains. By the time I got back down, I could barely walk. It took me 2 weeks to recover. I decided it would be unwise to climb the other ridge in search of the exact spot that Joseph had taken his image. When I began taking photos for Colorado Then and Now nearly 20 years later, the task of finding the locations where Joseph Collier once stood had become much easier. In the short time span, the internet had revolutionized the world. I can now do research online rather than the library. I can also open Google Earth and take virtual trips across Colorado, often viewing the spots where Joseph stood before ever leaving my house. I was able to find locations that had eluded me when capturing images for the first book. Technology has also greatly changed how we capture images. In 1995, I traveled across Colorado with a film camera and printed all of the images in the dark room. While cameras and film had evolved since the late 1800s, the underlying technology I used for capturing and printing photographs was largely the same. Today, I shoot with a digital camera, and my darkroom is on a computer. I can overlay the modern photos on top of the historic images and align them with amazing precision. It's also much less expensive to capture photographs. If I'm not certain of the exact spot Joseph took his images, I can take numerous shots in a grid like pattern, moving just a small distance between each shot. I can later compare the photos on the computer and see which one was closest to Joseph's image. It seems that technology has changed nearly as much in the last 20 years as it did in the 100 years before that. Prior to 1900, it probably took 500 years for technology to change the same amount. Our technological advancements are increasing at an exponential rate. While this can make life better, it can also have its drawbacks. Change can happen so fast that we have no time to plan for it, no time to understand how it will affect our lives. We now have powerful computers in our pockets, inside our watches, and even in our glasses. Digital technology is so ubiquitous that it seems to have merged with who we are as a people. We spend a large percentage of our lives interacting with these devices. The pace of change will only continue to increase, and soon the digital devices may not be separate from us, but implanted within us. They could change what it means to be human, altering our evolution as a species. We need to think long and hard about what role we want technology to play in our lives. If history has taught us anything, it is that advancements in technology can be very dangerous if not accompanied by forethought and wisdom. Technology has also transformed our landscape in recent years. New hydraulic fracturing techniques have allowed for more economical extraction of oil and natural gas throughout Colorado. Over 20,000 new fracking wells have been drilled in Colorado since 2005. Although these wells have helped the economy grow, environmental groups have argued that the cost in terms of air and water pollution and the exacerbation of global warming outweigh any benefits. Colorado has also become a leader in renewable energy, and there are now over 1,500 wind turbines in the state and several solar energy firms. Although there has been some opposition to these projects, including environmental concerns, studies have shown that renewable sources have far lower carbon footprints over their lifetime than non-renewable sources. To minimize the effects of global warming, they appear to be vital to our future. Although technology has transformed Colorado's landscape in many ways, there are still wild places that have changed little in thousands of years. There are currently 4 national parks, 8 national monuments, and over 3 million acres of wilderness in Colorado. When I visit these places, I like to leave behind cell phones, tablets, and other devices that can distract from the moment. I want to remember the world as Joseph Collier knew it. I want to hear the soft wailing of mountain streams, the enchanted choruses of birds, and the impassioned howls of coyotes. I want to feel the warm summer breezes and the frigid dust of winter. I want to gaze at the irradiant stars and planets and immerse myself in the infinite expanse of the universe. I want to feel fear and pain and awe and delight. These are things that make being human a beautiful experience, and hopefully that will never change. Thank you.
I actually have a question for you.
Okay.
I looked through your book earlier, and when I see pictures then and now, I'm almost sad. What was sad to see was that it happened to what was. There, you talked about any of your some discoveries or that you said that you saw, bad that, or yeah, wish that was, and you know,
what that was for you? Yeah. I think there are sort of mixed reactions for me, because even by the time Joseph Collier got into Colorado in 1870, the landscape had already been pretty dramatically transformed by mining and by logging. And in some cases, the mountainsides were completely bare of trees. And today there's a lot more trees than there were then. So in some ways, there are certainly things that have improved. But obviously, there are some pretty dramatic changes, and some of them for the worse. There are plenty of towns that have completely disappeared. I think obviously the biggest changes have occurred in Denver, where they tore down a lot of the historic buildings and replaced them with large size skyscrapers. So I think there's both reason for concern and a reason for optimism at the same time. So.
I see clearly which one you're at. So, in terms of technology, how does technology threaten technology itself? Does it threaten craft technology?
I don't think so, personally. I think there's a lot of people who think that Photoshop can really alter photography too much to make it unrealistic. But if you look back at photographers like Ansel Adams, they've always done a lot of work in the dark. They've done a lot of work in the darkroom to alter their photographs and make them more pleasing artistically. I think it gives more options artistically. But at the same time, I do think, and something I want you to do is, if you do change a photo, tell what you're doing, let people know. I think the biggest reason for the bad reputation is those photographers out there who will put a moon in a shot that is obviously fake, but claim that it's completely real. So the biggest thing for me is just to be honest and forthright with how you do it and the process you use.
I'm just curious, did you find places in Colorado that you had to
There wasn't, and for the second book, I can't say I did, because I've done, like I said, my first book I started back in 1995, and since then I've done about 8 other books in Colorado, so I've traveled around so much that there was some new, slightly new locations where I traveled, like hiked in about a mile or so of the places I hadn't been before, but for the most part I was really familiar with the state back then. For my first book, I had never even been to the San Juan Mountains and a lot of other places in Colorado. So my first book, I discovered a lot of new places. And like I said, that was more challenging because I couldn't do that much research beforehand, and I had to kind of go and just sort of search around in places I had been to before. So.
And I always wonder, so I'm glad you explained this, since the photo was from your grandfather, but I always wonder, are all of those from, or do you find from the library, or are they all from the people you know?
Actually, yeah, all of the images in this book were by my great-great grandfather because he took a ton of pictures around Colorado. Most of them were, they'd actually gotten scattered all around the U.S., and we didn't have hardly any in our family. And my grandfather went around and collected a ton of them, and he donated most of those to the Denver Public Library. But we kept copies, so most of them were from our collection, but I found some new ones from the Denver Public Library, and also there's a private individual who has a huge collection of images. I found some from him, but most of them were our own.
Now, I'm wondering if you've ever had any experiences where you're in the spot where your great-great-grandfather was, and there was any kind of moments about that.
Yeah, there was. A reporter asked me for my first book if I'd ever felt the ghost of my great-great-grandfather, and I just said no, and I think that kind of ruined her story. But but I can say for the, and I was 22 back then, but I can say for the this book, I sort of sometimes would get almost an eerie sense of a deja vu, you'd call it, just realizing that he really was at the spot 120 years ago, and I guess it more made me more aware of my own mortality, just that moment that, okay, he really was there, whereas when I was 22, I was just trying to make it as a photographer. I didn't really, so. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Our final reader of the evening is Ed Sealover from Colorado Excursions with History, Hikes, and Hops. Ed is a reporter with the Denver Business Journal covering state government, tourism, and the beverage industry. Over his 20-year journalism career, he has received 77 state, regional, and national awards in categories ranging from investigative reporting to political reporting to public service. He's been writing about beer since 2003, including the book Mountain Brew, A Guide to Colorado's Brewery, 2011, and his ongoing Beer Run blog. I'll have to look at that. Colorado is replete with natural beauty, award-winning breweries, and a history that reflects its wild and rugged character. Sealover offers this detailed guide to 10 three-day excursions full of nature, history, and unique watering holes. Readers discover sprawling parks and celebrated landmarks throughout the state and visit oddball destinations like the Trail of America's Favorite Cannibal and the renowned ghost town of St. Elmo. Please welcome Ed.
Great. Well, thanks for having me here, and thanks for everybody who stayed for all of this here tonight. I'm gonna do a little half explanatory, half reading here. First of all, to give you a little idea, what is Colorado Excursions with History, Hikes, and Hops? It is 30 days of traveling the state and stopping each day at one historic site, one natural site, and one drinking site. It is what I like to think of as a travel guide, but a travel guide that really goes more in depth than most of you are gonna find to try to find the spirit of this state. Now, the question I usually get, and one that many of you are asking, is how the hell did you pick these three things? And there's two reasons. One is, these are literally my three favorite things in the world. I love looking into local and national history. I love getting outside, whether it be for a hike, a drive, any kind of just quiet time in nature. And I also love locally made beer, which is what led me to write my first book in 2011, looking at each of the breweries that was then in the States. But I really do believe, as I kind of thought about what I wanted to do as a follow-up book, this is also what defines Colorado, because where are we if not for our rugged Western history and some of the unique ways that the state came around, the awe-inspiring scenery ranging from the top of 14ers to the class 3 and 4 rapids you can ride through Browns Canyon, to the craft ethos that is played out best probably in the 350-plus craft breweries we now have in the state, that has really found itself inking its way into the craft distilling, the local wineries, the farm-to-table restaurants, and even the exuberant niche retail that we see here in Colorado. So I tried to capture all of that in 95 locations, not 90, because I double and one time triple booked the day for people to make sure they saw everything they could. And I divided it up into a couple of ways. One is, I had the no-duh locations in here, the places you can tell anyone to come to the state, whether that be Rocky Mountain National Park, Mesa Verde National Park, Great Sand Dunes. But I really try to go out of my way when I'm going to the no-duh locations to explain what's a little bit different about them. Taking someone down to Mesa Verde isn't just asking them to want to kind of ponder the mysteries of the dwellings and what happened to the ancestral prevalence, but I insist that they get up in this book too and walk along Knife Edge Trail, which is a rarely visited trail in the northwest part of the park, where over a 2-mile span you see the plants that the ancestral prevalence used to make medicine, used to dye their clothing, used to thatch their roofs, and you really understand what life was like in this rugged environment beyond just the stops that you can get on tours. And I also like to do things sometimes that are a little more fun, like going to Great Sand Dunes. Everybody probably knows not just how to get up, but which dune to climb up. I decided to try to tell people how to get down. If the path up is tough but rewarding, the return trip downhill is more of an excuse for childlike adventure. Some visitors barrel down in kayaks or sandboards they've rented outside the park and hauled to the top. Those without equipment have the option of walking down, moving from point to point, or rolling shoulder over shoulder down the open slope, stopping only when the world is spinning at too fast a pace. The latter option is highly recommended. In addition to the places that you know to go, I really wanted to take this book, though, to look into a lot of the places that people don't go all the time and to really try to find the hidden gems, the off-the-beaten-path places that tell the deeper story of Colorado. So the historical sites include the aforementioned Mesa Verde, they include the state capitol, they include places like that, but they also include places like the town of Deerfield, an African-American colony 34 miles east of Greeley, that now is actually just 5 decrepit buildings, but that I want to tell the story of how it was a safe haven for black Denverites in the 1910s who left what was becoming an ugly racial atmosphere down here and moved up there to start dry land farming in could be desolate conditions and made it a wonderful place to be for nearly 2 decades. I include, as mentioned in the reading too, the trail of cannibal Alfred Packer, taking people down to the most remote city in the lower 48 states, Lake City, and even taking them onto the plateau where Packer either murdered and ate, or just ate, depending on which story you believe, 5 people, just so they can stand in that isolated atmosphere, that even isolated atmosphere today, and understand how a party that was lost in the snow, lost in the cold, could have gotten so disheveled and led to such a heinous crime at that time. Among the natural sites, I go to Rocky Mountain National Park, I go to the top of Pikes Peak, but I also go to Old Gold Camp Road, a dirt road, a former a railroad trail, stretching between Colorado Springs and Victor, that is now probably the single best leaf-peeping site in the state, if you know how to get there. And then I go to places that even surprised me when I was researching the book, places like John Martin Reservoir. Bent County is a land of sagebrush and echoes, packing just 5,600 folks into its 1,500 square miles and feeling every bit as sparse as when traders carved the Santa Fe Trail through it. But what may seem vacant to the human eye is a paradise to the 373 species of birds that pass through or take up part-time residence within its borders, making this outpost of southeastern Colorado one of the best bird-watching locations in the interior United States. At the heart of that aviary activity is John Martin Reservoir. And then as I go through the drinking stops in the book, I go to the places that you might expect. I'm going to take people through Odell Brewing and through Oscar Blues, and I'm going to tell them the backstory of why these are such nationally respected breweries. But I also take people to the Silver Dollar Saloon, which may not have the world's greatest beer list, but can brag about being the Leadville location outside of which Doc Holliday shot and killed his last man in a gunfight. And that was the symbol of all that was Lachine radius of Leadville back in its boom days. And I also take them to places that are far, far off the beaten path, such as a place that I truly love in the San Luis Valley town of Del Norte called Three Barrel Brewing. When people drop into Three Barrel Brewing, owner John Bricker asks if they'd like a pizza with their beer. It's a far cry from the brewery's early days, when he'd inquire whether they wanted to renew their home insurance policy while they were drinking in his office. In a town that has more buffalo herds, two, than stoplights, one, you do some unusual things to grow a brewery. For Bricker, that meant making beer in a space in the back of his insurance office for 8 years after opening in 2005. He eventually put in a bar next to the agency before going for broke and establishing a 62-seat pizza restaurant in November 2014. And I'll say, I've just been reading little snippets from what are typically 400 to 500-word descriptions of the places they send people, but Three Barrel is also known now as being, despite its out-of-the-way location, one of the best sour beer makers in all of Colorado. So ultimately, yeah, it is a travel guide, but it is also my love letter to Colorado, and it's not just my way of saying everything that I've loved in my 17 years there, but also my exhortation for people to go out and find that deeper part of Colorado that they haven't found, and to find that connection to its past, its still evolving present, and the beautiful future that we have here. And so lastly, I was just going to read one of my sections, one of my favorite sections here on my trip, historically speaking, to the city of Silverton. The town of Silverton blew up in the 1870s after the U.S. government pushed the Utes off the surrounding land and pent-up prospectors rushed in to seek gold and silver. While other towns boomed, busted, and disappeared, Silverton was home to precious metal activities for 120 years, enough to keep it alive, but never enough after World War I to provide the secluded town with sufficient economic activity to revitalize. Thus, according to local historian Beverly Rich, the town has the highest concentration of pre-World War I architecture in the United States. It's not just Victorian-era buildings that make the small downtown area a mandatory historic stroll, though. Buildings on the notorious Blair Street, home to 32 bordellos, saloons, and casinos, have been preserved or rebuilt. Brothels were so ingrained in the city's culture that the last lady of the evening left town in 1949, meaning the Nazis were vanquished before Silverton was prostitute-free. Silverton also is one of the most unique mining-era structures in the United States, the Mayflower Mill. While gold mine tours are common, gold processing mill tours are rare, and many that exist have reproduction equipment. The Mayflower, however, shut down in 1991 after 63 years of operation, and owners locked the door and left equipment inside. Their loss is your gain. The mill was last built to handle the bounty coming out of nearby Arrostra Gulch. It processed 9.8 million tons of crude ore for gold, silver, and base metals, reaching a height of 1,200 tons per day. It also was an environmental pioneer, creating some of the first ponds for the safe disposal of mine tailings, the mounds of which can be seen just west of the mill. Visitors on self-guided tours can see the machines that were part of the process, from the bucket tram that delivered ore to the crusher plant, to the crusher plant that pulverized it, to the flotation areas where precious metals rose to the top. A half dozen machines still work with the push of a button. Harrowing pictures show miners riding trams across the valley, and a bin still holds 800 tons of crushed ore, putting briefly back into the boomtown era. Silverton's 625 residents rely on tourism rather than natural resources these days, yet the newly quaint charm leaves you torn between enjoying the peace and wanting to step back to a much rowdier time. Thank you.
Just some questions about beer and excursion.
Yes.
I should get that so then, but the West are like, we can be saying that we don't tell everybody that we have to.
Well, if you buy the book, I do tell you. I mean, there's a couple. One of the things that most fascinated me when I was, and I did, I've been living here since 2000, but I made sure to revisit every place I'd been and try to find new places in the summer of 2015. Me and my wife and my then one-year-old son touring the state to do all of this. And what the great surprise I found was a place called Zapata Falls, which is just south of the Great Sand Dunes. I knew it was going to the sand dunes. And the climb around there is going to really rediscover it. But Zapata Falls is about 3 miles down an old beat-up BLM road, and it's a half-mile hike that is really unmemorable right up until you hit a grotto in the back where you have to zigzag across a stream, getting into the stream several times, and you literally end up inside this grotto where the waterfall is right in front of you. In fact, it's not just right in front of you. People climb up into the waterfall, and they're standing in this amazing scene, and it's probably the most surreal thing that I found on my trip there. And it was just kind of luck that I was flipping around and trying to find other interesting things in the San Luis Valley to visit while we were down there. And that was, it was such a kind of game-changing visit for me that I still talk about it to this day. I mean, there's a lot of like little hidden gems I like to put in here. Even really geeky stuff. Like, I take people to the Museum of Colorado Prisons because I think to understand Colorado's history, you have to understand what a lawless place this was to begin with. And a museum that is inside of an old women's prison located next to a currently functioning medium security prison that tells the history of the lawlessness and lets you look into the electric chair that put 8 people to death is really one of those wake-up calls as to what Colorado has been, aside from the beauty of the state.
Any other questions?
Yes, Steve.
Your field, right?
Yes.
Yes. I've read things about it, and I feel like people are unsure why it's been, why it's a billboard, what happened at the end of the 20 years, why it stopped.
Yeah. Deerfield was founded in 1910, and it grew pretty well for the first 10 years. And in fact, a lot of Colorado Eastern Plains communities grew like this, especially around World War I, when prices for crops were inflated because they were so needed, and because the 1910s were a very wet decade, and so people were able to grow things easily. They were able to sell them for great amounts of money, and a lot of people went in and mortgaged their farms and said, this is going to last forever. Well, after World War I ended, the prices collapsed. The rain stopped falling as much, and people found themselves in debt and losing their farms to the bank. And Deerfield was, in many ways, no different. One of the things, the reasons it kept itself alive through the 20s was it also became a social center for the African American community back then. People would literally ride the train up from Denver to this place we go there now that is in the middle of nowhere to attend dances and to go to the restaurant, because this was a place of safety, and it was a place of community. So it actually probably kept it alive longer than it should have. And by the 30s, when the economy collapsed, there were a few people out there. The original founder died in 37 after trying to sell it off as a resort area, which, if you know Weld County, it's not much of a resort area, actually. And the final resident died in 1973. The cool thing about it is it's one of those where I send people out there, and you might look around and say, what on earth are you sending out here for? It's a very desolate spot, but the Museum of the Black American West has invested in it and is trying to bring it back and trying to build up some of the old structures again and tell the story of really one of Colorado's bravest colonists.
Ready up?
Right. Oh, yes.
I'm wondering if the writing
there's You know, I don't know that there's one thing. I had written the beer book in 2011, and I wanted to kind of stay with that because I love beer writing, but I wanted to really try to transition into history a little bit as well. And as I dug more into the historic sites and found some of the really unique history, and I should say Deerfield's a great example of this, is that Colorado wasn't just a home of this one fantastic colony. It was the home of utopian colonies for people of all kinds. There was a Mormon colony in the San Luis Valley in the late 19th century. There was a colony in southeastern Colorado that was started by the Salvation Army, where they relocated destitute Chicagoans here to have a new life if they could build their own community. And just the idea of Colorado as a destination, as a kind of rebirth for some of the people that came out here, whether it be people coming out here after the Civil War, they kind of burned out from society, if you will, to the people who came out here to seek their fortunes in the gold rush, to the people who still come out here today because we have cutting-edge technology industries. The idea of Colorado as destination is what I really want to focus on for my next project, which I haven't quite nailed down, but to understand why this is a magnet and beyond just the beautiful mountains, why people value this as more than just one of those 50 states. Yes?
Welcome to a collaboration.
Yeah, the photos in here, not as good as yours. Good. Well, thank you all for coming out.